What's next? Now that the House committee investigating the January 6th riot has presented evidence that points toward criminal wrongdoing by President Trump's lawyers, it's not clear if Trump himself will ever face charges.
And it is Friday, so let's bring in our politics roundtable. Jesse Holland is here. He is Sunday host on C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Jesse, welcome.
Thank you.
So all of these January 6th hearings have had some very big moments, including yesterday's. There was new information about the pressure campaign on the vice president to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Jesse, what was your big takeaway yesterday?
Well, for me, the biggest takeaway is that it seems our current form of democracy was saved by one man, and that's former Vice President Mike Pence. But the thing that really shocked me is that the lack of trust Pence had in not only former President Donald Trump, but for the security people who worked with him. One of the things that we can see is that Pence actually got great advice from former Vice President Dan Quayle and from federal judge Michael Luttig, but all it took was a different decision by Pence there in the Capitol, and the democracy as we know it now would have been changed, or would have been at least irreparably damaged. So it's amazing to say that in this century, and frankly, in the past this decade, in these past few years, it took the courage of one man to keep our American democracy continuing the way it is today. But that seems to be what it was. If it hadn't been for former Vice President Mike Pence, we might be in a different place when it comes to government in the United States today.
Let me bring in Enrique Acevedo, a correspondent for CBS News. Enrique, gripping testimony from Vice President Mike Pence's legal counsel, Greg Jacob, telling the January 6th committee about a conversation he'd had on January 5th. With Trump lawyer John Eastman, the man who apparently orchestrated this strategy to have Pence overturn the election knowing that it was illegal. I want to play a clip of Greg Jacob. Here he is.
When I pressed him on the point, I said, John, if the vice president did what you were asking him to do, we would lose 9-0 in the Supreme Court, wouldn't we? And he initially started it, well, I think maybe you would lose only 7-2. And after some further discussion, acknowledged, well, yeah, you're right. We would lose 9-0.
So over and over again, it appears the Trump team knew, and the president himself was told that this strategy would not succeed and could lead to violence, never mind that it was potentially illegal. Right, Enrique?
Yeah, it's remarkable testimony, and we've seen that over and over again during the first three hearings. But taking a step back and looking at things from a larger perspective, at a time when we're all learning more details of just how serious the threat to our democratic order has been or was on January 6th, I think the hearings are an encouraging sign, actually, of institutional strength or resilience, if we want to call it that. The lesson here is that if you care about democracy, you should also care about its institutions. People sometimes see them as bureaucracy, but I think we should pay more attention to these instruments of democracy, not just the individuals, how we elect people to lead and represent our institutions, how we finance and manage those institutions. I mean, having said that, we also need to recognize that democracy is as much about legitimacy as it is about performance, about results. Mm-hmm. So the real challenge for the hearings is what happens now, right? What happens after the facts are presented openly, transparently, and all of us know what happened on January 6th.
Jesse, what about that? What does happen now? Do you expect the president to be charged with a crime? A lot has to happen for that to happen.
Well, we have to understand that the January 6th committee is performing literally for two different audiences. They're performing for the audience of the American people. They're performing for the court of public opinion. But all of this is also a performance for Attorney General Merrick Garland, because it is only Merrick Garland who can decide whether there should be charges against former President Donald Trump. And the committee is laying out a case for him to make those charges. In the end, however, we should understand that all of this is going to end up eventually in front of the Supreme Court. And the question that I have is that John Eastman somehow thinks that there were at least two possible votes for something unconstitutional, which he clearly believes and knows is unconstitutional. But at first he thought there were two votes for an unconstitutional action on the Supreme Court. I'm wondering who he thinks those two votes were.
You know, I was so struck yesterday by the images presented by the January 6th committee. They were so powerful, especially those of Vice President Mike Pence down in that loading dock during the riot after refusing to leave the Capitol building. He'd come within 40 feet of the mob at one point. Here is committee member Pete Aguilar, a Democrat, summing up Mike Pence that day.
He started his day with a prayer and ended his day with a Bible verse. I fought the good fight. I finished the race. I've kept the faith.
It's clear what Mike Pence did that day was historic. Do these hearings change the political future of Mike Pence as he eyes a presidential bid in 2024? Enrique, what do you think?
Well, he positions himself as a political actor that believes in democratic order, which I have to say is not necessarily the case for some of the forces that control the Republican Party today. And I say that with a heavy heart. I don't take that statement lightly. I think that the fact that Mike Pence can differentiate himself from others in his party only because he believes in democracy and rule of law and institutions, I think it says a lot about the political moment that we're going through right now and that we're approaching in 2024. So definitely, I think for those of us who want a candidate, look for these qualities in a candidate, I think this displays to his political strength. It should be a basic, right? But it's not the case anymore.
Yeah. Listen, I want to move on because we have just a couple minutes left here. There's the economy is in rough shape. The president's trying to deal with that. But there's also this question of guns. The lead Republican negotiator on new gun control measures in the Senate has walked away from the talk saying it's time to either fish or cut bait. Here's John Cornyn yesterday on the Hugh Hewitt radio show.
People like to come back and try to renegotiate things all the time. And I think we're about run out of our rope here, and we got to make some final decisions today if we're going to be able to get this on the floor next week.
Jesse, talk about the timeline here and whether or not you think Senate negotiators are going to get this done when it looked like they were very, very close.
This is how the Senate works. They get close, they back away, they get close again, they back away, try to get more, try to get less. They will vote on something. Now, whether the something they vote on is actually effective at reducing the number of guns used in mass killings and illegal activities in the United States is a whole nother question. I do think both Republicans and Democrats realize they have to take a vote on something. Whether it's such something is effective or not, I don't know. But I am confident that the Senate will sooner or later, whether next week or the week after, take a vote on something to do with guns. Once again, whether that vote and that bill is effective at all, that I can't say, but just for their own political futures and to lay cover for themselves in case another mass shooting happens, the politicians in Washington, D.C. will vote on something and say, hey, we tried.
Enrique, what do you think is going to happen here? You see a deal after Buffalo, Uvalde, and elsewhere?
I was covering Sandy Hook almost 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago, and I thought we were going to see a deal right after that, and we're still waiting. So I'm not overly optimistic. But again, taking a step back, I think it's worth remembering that gun violence in the U.S. is not a domestic issue anymore. Cities like El Paso and Uvalde are overwhelmingly Mexican-American communities with deep ties to both countries. So this action that we're talking about is required to save lives here at home, but also abroad, where American-made weapons fuel destruction and death. Last year, Mexico's government filed a historic lawsuit accusing gun companies in the U.S. of lethal negligence and on a mass scale, and that includes the maker of the AR-15, Colt.
Enrique, maybe we can get to both of you on this. Just real briefly, what story jumped out at you this week that has gone under the radar? Because there's been so many big stories that we have been focused on. Enrique, why don't you start?
I appreciate the question, and I would have to say the 10th anniversary of the executive decision that marked the creation of DACA, the program that has benefited hundreds of thousands of dreamers, so-called dreamers, young kids that are American in every sense. They just don't have a document that says so, and that have contributed so much to our society and became essential more than ever during the pandemic. So I think that was a story that was underreported 10 years after, like guns and so many other issues. We're still debating. We're still trying to see action in Congress to make that executive order permanent.
Jesse, can you give us an answer in 20 seconds?
Yes, the underreported story right now is the warnings of a upcoming housing bubble, which crashed the economy back in the early 2000s. Economists are warning about it right now, and I don't think enough people are paying attention.
Great panel, good information. Jesse Holland, Sunday host of C-SPAN's Washington Journal, and Enrique Acevedo, correspondent for CBS News. Many thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.